Hello and welcome to another Your Politics, RTE's weekly politics podcast from our team at Leinster House. I'm Áine Lawler. With me this rainy afternoon, my colleagues Juliet Gash and Joe McGraelig. And Joe, this Thursday afternoon, we have Doyle's statements on the Middle East. Of course, the USA and Israel at war with Iran since the weekend. In the days since, the surrounding Middle East countries are also being dragged into this conflict. We have thousands of stranded Irish people looking to get to safety and be evacuated. Shipping is shut down in the Strait of Hormuz, a key global shipping route, especially for energy. And at home, we already have fury over price gouging with petrol, diesel and home heating oil already up in many places since the weekend. So how's the Dáil been reacting, Joe?
When you put it all together like that, on you,
it's quite something.
It sounds
ain't it?
Very, very depressing. I guess. I mean, if you think about it, last Friday evening we all went home from work. You know, maybe went out, had a couple of drinks, whatever it was. End of a long working week, and then by Saturday morning, all this had started. Nobody had expected it to start. I mean, obviously the Americans were rattling the saber to an extent, but then suddenly, just this war breaks out, and the immediate effect once again on the world economy and on the cost of living and on fuel prices is being felt, just like we felt it when Ukraine was invaded by Russia back in 2022. So, I mean, it has come straight to the top of the agenda, of course, in the Dáil. And specifically, I mean, the two big issues really are getting those who are stuck in the Middle East home, which is something that is ongoing. And then the other thing is the immediate cost on energy prices and very definitely on the cost of home heating oil. Because, of course, at this time of the year, if the weather was a bit fairer, but as you mentioned there at the outset, it's pouring rain once again in Dublin. I got soaked three times today in the course of my work. If the weather was getting better, we wouldn't all have to be buying these extra fills of oil, et cetera, et cetera. But now we are. So, I mean, we heard today, and we've heard it over the last number of days, David Cullinan putting it to the Taoiseach. What was €500 for a fill is now €800. What we heard about the cost of petrol and diesel during the week, by the way, of which 65% of the cost of petrol goes to the state, 60% of the cost of diesel goes to the state. That was according to Patrick Tobin when he was talking about it. And the need now for the state to do something to intervene once again. But of course, we're not seeing that. The Taoiseach, although it is interesting now because, you know, the government so far have said no. And they've said, look, we're extending the fuel allowance, et cetera, et cetera. That was the tune that we heard from the Taoiseach today and from other ministers over the last number of days. And that is significant. An extra 50,000 people are going to be getting that. But it's the broader sweep of the population who won't get anything. And that's targeted at people generally in receipt of social welfare or generally pensioners.
Working family
payment, it's not something that's available for everybody. But of course, everybody still has to go to work tomorrow. Everybody is trying to fill the car. What was 165, 170, 175 is now 185, even 190, somebody said to me today. And it's an issue. It's an issue that's not going to go away. You know, the government are they've, of course, ruled out any interventions so far, but I think the pressure will be there.
And this, of course, against the backdrop of the government deciding in the most recent budget that the universal cost of energy supports, that they would not be provided to households. The minister now, following on from all these reports of price gouging, he's going to ask the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission to have a look at all of that and see if there's anything wrong there. He wants that done quickly. But again, the message that the government's been repeating, we heard it from the minister on the Week in Politics at the weekend, Juliet, they're going for targeted supports. But this war in the Middle East now, I mean, it's attuned to what the opposition parties have been saying non-stop since that budget, that they want those universal supports reinstated.
Absolutely. And the government will have said again and again that the problem with the universal once-off payments was that they weren't targeted to those who needed it most, that people who are very well off were getting their fuel allowance, and that this wasn't fair and wasn't sustainable. Now, the difficulty for the government is that the opposition has been banging this drum for a long time before we've seen these increases in fuel and diesel. And they are piling on top of the problems that we know exist for many, many people. The cost of groceries, the cost of living generally.
The energy arrears we also have
the threat of rents going up now that the new Residential Tenancies Act is in place since Sunday. It's just a pylon, essentially, for people who are already struggling to make ends meet. And actually, Brian Stanley today, the Independent TD, made the point of, you know, people with a disability struggling to heat their homes before this happened, before Iran was attacked. And it's really making things difficult. And also David Cullinan made an important point that a quarter of people have less than €500 in savings. So if they have to fill their tank with kerosene that's now almost doubled in price, how do they do that?
It's interesting, though. The government position seems to be, as far as I can ascertain, we're not doing anything immediately, but we're going to keep this under review.
Presumably they're hoping that this is a short-run war,
yes,
and that it won't have long-term economic impact.
Yes, and the argument then from Jack Chambers yesterday was that if you suddenly intervened, then you may actually reinforce some of this activity where prices are going up. So that, you know, that is an argument that is out there. But I think it's very interesting, though, as well, because I was speaking to one minister even just earlier on who said to me that the office is inundated with calls now about the costs of fuel, inundated. And same minister said, we're probably going to have to do something about this. We won't do it immediately, but we're probably going to have to do something about this.
And some criticism, too, of the fact that people being evacuated, the first flight out landed this morning, that people being evacuated at the moment, there's a contribution of €800 towards the cost of that flight. And there's also been some criticism, hasn't there, that we've been hearing on programmes like Liveline from people who are in the Middle East and saying we could actually be getting more information, we think, from the Department of Foreign Affairs or from the consulate.
I think essentially, so Helen McEntee was out yesterday, and she was talking about this repatriation flight. They won't confirm that it is Friday. They'll only say it's the end of the week, and it will be carrying, they said yesterday, more than 300 people. Now, people have to get to Muscat in Oman. That's a bus transfer. The government will be paying for that. And they are asking for the €800 contribution. Now, they're saying that pales in comparison to the cost of chartering a jet from Oman. But obviously, if people want to get out and have the means, they will be asked to pay that. Children won't have to pay, and they won't have to pay for the bus.
And the other question that's been arising politically as we all react to these events that are unfolding, and nobody knows quite where it's all going. The question that's been asked of the government, why can't you just call this war out for being illegal the way the Spanish Prime Minister did? Or even Keir Starmer, who refused to get involved on the first day because on the first day he deemed, his legal advice was, it was an illegal act to attack Iran. On the other hand, after the second day, when the British base on Cyprus had been attacked, then you were acting in self-defence and then it became legal. Nonetheless, you look at the reaction from the White House, from Donald Trump. What did he know? Winston Churchill, wasn't that? And, and also Donald Trump saying, right, that's it, no more trade with Spain. So why can't we call it out? But equally, the reaction from the White House when you do.
Well, I mean, that's the reason that the Irish government is going to call it out, because of the danger of the reaction from the White House and because of our small open economy and our need to trade and our need to keep these relationships good and in functioning relationships in terms of trade and in terms of diplomacy and over and back between us. It is, though, going to be very it's going to be very interesting to see what will happen now for the St. Patrick's Day visit. Because, of course, we saw Friedrich Merz, who is the head of the most powerful country in the in the EU, in Germany, the biggest economy.
The German Chancellor,
sitting there while Donald Trump traduced the
Spanish
Prime Minister, Sanchez, and traduced Keir Starmer. And Friedrich Merz essentially sat there and listened to it, and he wasn't being openly or overtly critical of what they've done either. I mean, I think what the Irish government here has said is that they would like to see this a rapid de-escalation. They would like to see that this would be sorted. They acknowledge there isn't a UN mandate or international mandate for it, but at the same time, they then point out that what was going on in Iran was beyond the ability of the UN to interfere with for a very long time in terms of all of the deaths of people that follow those recent protests across Iran. So the UN wasn't something that extended, or the mandate of the UN wasn't something that was able to cope with or extend to Iran. And Iran, of course, I think the Taoiseach also pointed out that Iran was backing and fomenting various groups around the Middle East and further afield, which was causing an awful lot of deaths of innocent people too.
Yes, and Juliet, we're hearing a lot, therefore, from our government about the rules-based international order. That's a theme they're going to be presumably sticking to in the run-up to this visit to the White House on the 17th. So just a fortnight to go now. You'll be there. This has become a problem for world leaders, hasn't it? What do you do when you go into the House, White House? We saw New York mayor, the left-wing mayor of New York, Mamdani, who actually has a really good relationship with Donald Trump. And he rocked up recently to the White House, and he brought with him a big prop, because Donald Trump loves a prop. So it was a mocked up front page from the New York Post, I think it was. And it was all about Trump, you know, invest big in housing in New York, and Trump loved all of this. So I don't know what kind of props Micheál Martin could bring
maybe
with him other than the shamrock.
Maybe he needs a gold shamrock bowl this time, because we know that Trump likes gold. Maybe that's what we need to look at. I know that they have craftsmen looking in and women looking into the manufacture of the shamrock bowl. It's a difficult one, because There needs to be an element of flattery, because he likes it, but you can't be obsequious. And the body language with Friedrich Merz was very interesting. He's taller than Trump significantly, and he sat there looking very confident and relaxed, and did give him more than I suppose the Germans expected him to in terms of not criticising the war. However, he did correct him on the whole, I'm not going to trade with Spain anymore, because he was like, well, that is part of the EU, you can't do that. So there is a very fine line to tread, and there will have to be that level of flattery and praise. But Micheál Martin has said he will raise the issue of the war and the legality. How far he'll go will be an interesting one to watch.
Am I correct in recalling that it was Macron that was there with Trump in the White House, and he was able to reach across and
there was lots of knee squeezing
and all that sort of thing. There was a real buddy-buddy. And yet Macron wasn't ever, you know, he was able to sort of take his positions too, very artfully. So I'm not sure will we see that now on the 17th of March.
And as well, will we see J.D. Vance in his shamrock socks again, or is that moment gone? You know, will there be that joviality? I don't know.
And while it's worth bearing in mind, you know, there aren't too many people, certainly even within Iran, shedding tears over the loss of Ayatollah Khamenei, although it seems his son will be his successor. But things like the fact that the Iranian regime, we know that they've killed around 30,000 of their own people in the recent protests. We know how brutal it can be. And yet at the same time, in all this talk about, you know, and we might make a bit of a joke, but how would you deal with Donald Trump? What we're looking at in the days since, you know, this was, Hegseth was saying, wasn't he, Pete Hegseth, we didn't start this war. Well, most people kind of think they did. Mm-hmm. They were in the middle of negotiations. Mm-hmm. And then actually, was it the Israelis who said, go now? Yeah. And America followed suit. A bit of a dispute about that. But we've seen a girls' school being bombed, 175 dead. That naval vessel coming back from those exercises in the Indian Ocean, apparently because it was naval exercises, that naval vessel was unarmed. So there are serious questions here, aren't there, about legality, maybe even war crimes?
Yeah, well, I mean, it comes down to whose law. I think the United States' view is that, you know, they make their own laws, and this is about American interests and the whatever about the writ of the UN and all the rest of it. I don't think Donald Trump is going to be too worried about that. I mean, obviously, the bombing of that school was absolutely horrendous. The sinking of the naval ship, unexpected attack by a torpedo, first time since World War II. We could watch it on our screens last night. It really left you sort of reeling when you realise that that's going on.
Pete Hegseth claiming that as a win, you know, that this is the first time we've used this since World War II. Most people think that that's a bad, you know, it's a good thing that there's been that time, that we don't want to return to this these sorts of...
But isn't the bigger question, though, what comes after?
Well, that's the question. This is the question people are asking all over the world. Is there a plan? Is there a way out of this? And there's no doubt the Trump administration, I mean, they've been emboldened by, they've been able to carry out successfully in their terms, lightning raids on Iran, lightning raids on Venezuela, taking out Maduro, lightning raids on the sea, the blockade of Cuba. They've been able to do all of these things, you know, short, sharp shocks.
Yeah.
And initially it seemed that's what they were planning here, but now it's becoming more open-ended. Yeah. Now we're hearing there's a big debate going on in Washington about boots on the ground or not.
Yeah.
We have seen all these other countries in the region being pulled in. So it doesn't take much for it to go very badly wrong. But we are, as Joe was saying, the UN is being ignored here, Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
We have Stephen Miller. He said before, they're in the... Their approach to power is might is right. They've got the power,
yeah.
They've got the might, and they've got the right to go and do what they want to do.
Absolutely. And I think, as you were saying, whose law? So international legal experts are saying, no, it is against international law. This idea of a preemptive strike, which was how it was first described, that can be used in terms of self-defense if there's evidence that this preemptive strike is warranted now. That threshold hasn't been met, so that's one problem. Now, the Republican-dominated Senate has today given him a bit more wriggle room in terms of continuing on with the war on Iran. But obviously the Democrats are trying to find ways of clipping his wings.
Before we move on to other topics, Joe, our UNIFIL mission, because of course the other thing that's happened here is Israel has told everyone in southern Lebanon, of course our troops there as part of the UNIFIL mission, to pull back north of the Litani River.
Yeah.
And they've gone in to Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, well, I mean, they do from time to time. They did it last year. And they have done it in the past as well. I mean, obviously, the Israelis are responding to what they say is the ongoing threat from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon.
Which chose to launch a weapon.
Which did actually once again start firing rockets into Israel as well. In terms of the UNIFIL troops, I mean, like last time, the UNIFIL took the decision that the troops would stay in position. And I mean, I've heard commentators talking about how the presence of UN troops in that region, which essentially becomes a sort of a front line conflict zone, was a huge comfort to the people who lived there because it was some sort of a buffer against, you know, the potential violence that was unfolding around them. So, I haven't heard differently. I would imagine that they'll be staying there once again throughout this latest phase, this latest conflict, again, however long it lasts.
Yeah. Already with the defence budget of $1 trillion in the USA, the White House now looking for another $50 billion for this war. So even if it's a short term, which is what many people around the world are hoping for, it's certainly going to be very expensive. Let's move on to other matters back here at home and park all that for the moment, Juliet. The Rotunda extension that was the source of so much complaint when on board the Planola turned down the application for an extension for the special premature baby unit and a sick baby unit. There's going to be a new application. How has that come about?
Yes, so essentially on Comisión Planola rejected this plan. Part of it was to do with the character of Parnell Square, which some people would say is debatable. But the main reason they were saying was essentially that there were plans by the government announced 11 years ago to co-locate the Rotunda with Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown. And those plans hadn't yet been abandoned. They have now been abandoned. Therefore, a new planning application can go in. Now, they are going to go for a bigger planning application in terms of not just the premature babies, but also a special care wing for mothers and the sexual assault treatment unit, which, of course, is based in the Rotunda. So that's going to go in. And Jennifer Carol McNeill, the health minister, saying yesterday that she hopes it can go in under this critical infrastructure so that it won't be as long and laborious to get the planning permission in. And I think, interestingly, the master of the Rotunda was saying that, you know, the initial ethos of the hospital was to care for the poor of Dublin. So to have moved the main maternity hospital, the busiest maternity hospital in the city centre, out of the city centre, I think would have been a terrible decision.
And Joe, we were hearing a lot in recent years, about Grace's Law, and this was after Grace Lynch's tragic death in January and Finglas killed by a scrambler bike. Then it emerged that the regulations, that the law is in place, but the regulations hadn't come into enforce in terms of an outright ban on scramblers. The Irish Times reporting now that it was, well, what was the reason for the delay in drawing up the regulations for an outright ban?
Yeah. This was a story by Ellen Coyne in the Irish Times. And basically, she's pointing out that the powers were there since 2023. But like many acts, an act is passed and it becomes law, but then there's regulations that have to derive from the act. So it was the regulations, as far as I can see, that were not signed and they weren't deployed. And this was something that, according to Ellen, was raised by An Gabhar the Síochána repeatedly with the Department of Transport. It was raised repeatedly with them in 2023. The response from the department was essentially that they were very busy with other major pieces of legislation and that they didn't get around to doing it, and so the laws were never actually signed, those laws, and ultimately then this horrible tragedy happened with the death of Grace Lynch, and now we will have these laws finally. They'll be called Grace's Law and they will be signed in the coming weeks. So it does raise questions about, you know, how the process works and about how things get prioritised or not prioritised.
Indeed.
Just going back to the rotunda there as well, we learned a little bit about the Critical Infrastructure Bill during the week as well from Jack Chambers. And one of the interesting things is that it will be up to the government to add particular projects to the Critical Infrastructure Bill, and the Dáil will get to vote on whether or not those particular projects will be included under the bill, essentially. So there'll have to be a Dáil confirmation of any one of these projects, which is an interesting device in a way, because if there's a critical infrastructure, a piece of infrastructure, the government will be able to say, look, this has got the backing of the House of the Oireachtas and of all of the TDs in the country, because there will be, a Dáil vote, a whipped vote, of course, to get it through.
Senator Michael McDougall, of course, has been pointing out for a while that's the way the Victorians used to get their infrastructure built. They just passed vote on the Dáil, and there you go. Speaking of research, Juliet and Cumasúin Toghchán, they've come up with some interesting findings. This is from research, because they're doing really interesting research. So when people go to vote, and Cumasúin Toghchán is out there asking all kinds of questions about the process and trying to make our electoral system work better.
Yes, absolutely. So on Cumasúin Toghchán, along with the National Election and Democracy Study, or NEDS, which I like, has released this information. They talked to voters. It's all around the presidential election in October. So they spoke to them in the first week of the campaign, in the week of the vote, and the week after the vote. So there was 3 points in time, and they tried to keep all the same amounts in. And so they had around 1,300 people who they spoke to, voters and non-voters alike, because, of course, we know that one of the major facets of this election was the amount of spoiled votes. So in their sample, there was 12% of people who spoiled their votes. That was the same nationally, and so much higher than the previous presidential election, which was around 1.2% in terms of spoiled voting. I suppose the reasons why people said they didn't want, why they spoiled their vote, number one, first reason, 45% of those who spoiled their vote said they didn't like any of the candidates. 27% felt the process for selecting candidates was unfair or undemocratic. 17% said not enough choice. 14% said it was a protest vote. So look at, we know that in the end there were three names on the ballot paper, but only two candidates finally, Catherine Connolly, who obviously won by a landslide, and Heather Humphreys. Other questions that were asked as well in that survey was there any... were there any of the candidates who were involved in negative campaigning? And 57% of people said Heather Humphreys was involved in negative campaigning, and she was almost at twice the rate of, or more than twice the rate of Catherine Connolly.
That's really interesting. Let me stop you there, because presumably that's related to the smear the bejesus comments, which came from Ivan Yates, who wasn't working on Heather Humphreys' campaign and had actually been coaching Jim Gavin for Fianna Fáil, which subsequently came out. So it certainly boomeranged, didn't it, Heather Humphreys?
It didn't do any favours, and I think she acknowledged that this was, you know, that she wouldn't use that sort of language anyway.
But I think Fine Gael in general were very upset at the end of the heel of the hunt, that was appended to them as if it was their position on things.
Yeah, it's really worth looking at and kind of going through. We don't have time for it now, but just, you know, like 69% of people, and these aren't the spoiled voters, we're not happy with the choice of candidates. Yeah. So that's a huge amount. That's, yeah. you know, more than two thirds of people saying, I'm not happy with this election. There wasn't a lot of names on the ballot and people are used to having more choice. And then there was a proportion of people who said that their candidate wasn't on the ballot paper. And of course, we had the Spoil Your Vote campaign, but it was a lot smaller than had been suggested, I suppose, on the airwaves or in comments that were made at the time, that there really was a groundswell of support behind any candidate mm-hmm. who didn't end up on the ballot paper. That was a lot smaller than people had said. But generally, people weren't that happy. You know, people did watch, more than half of people polled did watch one or more debates. So that, I suppose, gives credence to the work that we do in the media.
The presidential debates, I think, back fondly.
That said, the trust in what media outlets provided was not that high. You're talking around a third of people saying that they trusted. RTE managed to pip the broadsheets and the print media. But not by an awful lot. And so there's quite a big diversity in, you know, trust in what the media is saying and media engagement. So mm-hmm. they'll still watch it, even if they don't necessarily fully trust it. However, if I may say, in fairness to An Cumasúin Toghchán and the NED's researchers, there was massive trust in the election process. And so that's really important to say, that 97% of people felt it was easy to vote, and that in and around the 70s and 80% felt it was a transparent process, that it was fair, and that they were, you know, that they felt that their vote was done properly in private and in secret, and all the things that are so important when we do vote.
Lots of food for thought, and really for the political parties next time round, yeah. you know, and what approach they take to the selection process, what approach they take to whipping their councillors, whipping in inverted commas, if independents are looking for a nomination, etc., etc., because I mean, we've never seen it before, a Spoil Your Vote being deployed on purpose in order to mm-hmm. make a particular point. And it wouldn't have made any point if it was so small, but when it's 12%, it actually makes a huge point about dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Joe, speaking of someone who's looking for votes, Phil Hogan, formerly of the EU Commission, yeah. formerly of Fine Gael, and the minister who tried to bring in water charges, and that all had to be reversed. But he's done very well since in the European Commission. Of course, then he had to step down after Golfgate, and he's been working very successfully privately since. But he's won the government's backing for a big UN food and agriculture job. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes. One thing you can say about Phil Hogan is he's had a very storied career, that's for sure. And he's risen to the very heights, being EU Commissioner twice, of course. Essentially, there's a position. It's the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization, a UN body, 230,000 a year, and the government were looking for potential names.
He'd probably be taking a pay cut, actually.
There are questions as well about tax, though, I think, weren't there? That because it's an international world, there may be no tax. So if you can take all that home and you've got expenses and you get to live in Rome, I'd do it.
I think his communications company that he's been running, I think I read somewhere that it took in €1 million last year. So, I mean, it probably would
it's
be a pay cut.
It's been very successful one way or another. But the difference here, I suppose, would be power. He'd be back at the centre of power.
He would indeed, yeah. And he obviously still wants to serve in a role like this. I mean, it's a mountain to climb, because it's an election. You have to get the 193 countries all have a vote here.
So and Italy is running a candidate as well.
Italy has
a
candidate who's already part of the FAO. So Phil Hogan, I mean, certainly from what I was told at the beginning of this, when the nominations here in Ireland were sought, or sorry, the names were sought here mm-hmm. in Ireland, and it closed in January, that there was a kind of a sort of a cool enough view within government about him. But that seems to have changed. It seems now that the government are quite keen, and that there'll be some support for him as he goes about embarking on getting the support here, you know. I mean, I suppose it would obviously be a fantastic win for Phil Hogan once again, but it wouldn't be a bad thing for Ireland either to have the Director General of the mm-hmm. Food and Agriculture Organization.
Well, he's a man who knows a thing or two about running campaigns, isn't he?
He certainly does, yeah.
Phil
he
Hogan,
certainly does.
Yes, and certainly and credited with a lot of the success that Enda Kenny enjoyed. So we'll see how well he works on the UN stage here.
We'll bring him on the podcast as soon as he's available.
All right. Look, the weather's dreadful, the news is grim, but we've tried to fill you in as best we can, and we'll do it all again next week. Till then, slán.